Act 2. Chapter 12. 6 months before the Emperor's murder. On last count, you'd killed 12 planets, but you still found that first quick slice to the jugular the hardest. You felt your own breath wet on your face in your crinkly hazard suit, worn to keep the dust off. Needless, at least for the moment. You judged the angle. You hesitated. Your unwilling tutor mistook your hesitation for anticipation, sitting opposite you in her own rustling orange suit, the triple light of the three-star sunset dyeing her face orange through the soft plex stuff of the hood. A light hail of sand and dust particles pattered over the fabric and went plinkety-plinkety-plink.
"Don't bother waiting for the timer, Harrowhark," she said, muffled behind layers of amalgam plastic and thermal fibre.
She was already sitting in the posture of submergence, knees high, back a soft curve, hands light over the fronts of the shins.
"I'm confident you don't need a timer anymore, and it'll drop to flash freezing out here in half an hour, so hurry up. It won't be me they'll be emptying out of the dustpan for the funeral."
Mercy added this with no small relish. Your brain said, "Fuck you for choosing this particular climate, you bursting organ, you wretched, self-regarding hypochondriac and half-fermented corpse with the nails still on." But your mouth said,
"Necessarily, eldest sister."
Mercy Morn watched as you extracted your sword, not the rapier that hung from your hip, which God had asked you to wear and which you wore as a sop to his extreme optimism, the greatsword that you carried on your back. Your exoskeleton came into play here. The plates you wore in long overlapping scales running from back to ribs to elbow to forearm, the rudimentary appendages that helped you heave a blade far too heavy for your body. Not for you, the light ripple of muscle that now showed on Ianthe's back and shoulders, especially if she was wet with sweat. For you, the socket, the bone, the external ridge. All the Saint of Joy said was,
"I never needed the dramatics, but go on, and try not to do anything tectonic."
As you had never done anything tectonic in the past, it was with an edge of resentful fury that you lifted the hilt high above your head. You drove the point of the bone-sheathed blade into the talc. Obviously, you never wanted it to have an edge of any kind ever again. And using the sword as your focus, drove a killing lance of Thanagy right into the planet's heart. The planet did not quake or howl. Or freeze, or writhe, skewered on your necromancy's tines. You began the cascade outward, as you had been taught. A wide, thanagetic scythe sheared out into the mantle, deeper into the minute thalagy of the rock, into the solid stone's buried recollections of the day its ball of dust was formed. So much more difficult on a planet of this character. That was why Mercy Morn had chosen it, along with the hope that you would end up an ice corpse. The Thanagy reaction had to be carefully wrought. Here, the soul of the planet was in the striations of its sand and minerals, a soft, woven network of miniature creatures, of bacteria, of thin, stretched-out skeins of life. You had not even understood what to look for the first time. Now you felt it as you felt the sand scouring the outside of your suit. You fell to a sitting position and adopted the same posture as Mercy Morn. Feet flat on the sand as the wind howled, your spine a soft C-curve. This way, when it was over, you wouldn't have a serious backache. You pressed your haz-shod shoe tips to the upright blade of the sword, and you felt the planet become aware that it was dying. The cascade was perfect. Your cascades always were. The Thanagy scoured through the soul like a lit taper touched to flimsy. The living flush of this rocky outcrop began to die in dizzying concentric rings, flipping, the Thanagy feeding on the thalagy as locusts fed on wheat. As the soul tore away, an extra thanagetic bloom fanned the fire of what you had already done. You were satisfied with the precision of your strike. You did not sit around anxiously as you had done the first half a dozen times, but you closed your eyes, and you waded into the river even as the ghost of the planetoid started to rock itself free. Teacher had described the bone or flesh magician's transition to the river as like a sculptor being given a bowl of water and told, "Build a statue," whereas the spirit magician was a swimmer given a block of marble and told, "Do a lap." You loved God like a king, and you loved God like the promise of redemption, and you loved God like you weren't even sure what you had loved so seldom. But you hated his analogies with the depth and breadth of your soul. Sculptor or swimmer, letting go proved more difficult than anything else. Part of you was always dimly frightened of it. Your fellow necro-saint in training now bragged that she could do it near instantaneously, like closing her eyes, she always said. You had never found it natural. Your mind you dug out of your meat, and you drove it downward, always downward somehow, and pushed with your awareness until you felt underfoot the dagger-sharp rocks of that grey and unimaginable shore beneath that grey and featureless sky. Then a step into that icy water, and another, until you were waist-deep and might open your eyes. You could see where the planet's soul was thrashing. The ghosts had parted as though promptly combed away from that turbulent whirlpool churning. A minor beast. No resurrection beast, of course. This newborn ghast would need 1,000 years of malign intent to become anything close to a true beast. Or so you were told. You'd still never seen a true beast. The great two-handed sword was in your hands, now light as forgiveness. You hauled yourself up to stand upon the face of the churning grey waters, and, wet through with filthy, bloodied spume, you began to walk toward the maelstrom. You knew without venturing a look over your shoulder that Mercy Morn the First stood on the shore watching critically, the hem of her pearlescent Canaanite robes wet through. She was probably making faces at the growing stain. In the river, her hurricane eyes were scouring, widening curlicues of ruddy grey, excruciating to look upon. You were glad that Mercy would see your facility with the spirit, a skill you were killing yourself trying to perfect. Nonetheless, you were also glad she was not close enough to distract you as you approached the jerking, squirming soul, a nightmarish mess of the organic and the inorganic, all of it a false mirage of spirit stuff. It was a mass of bloody, crumbling rock faces. It was a hexapod with hairy insect legs, bristling with clay-covered spines. It was primarily grey, but a gory, slimy, sandy grey, organically seething yet still somehow stone-like. And it made a break for it. Mercy Morn hollered from the shore, her voice a muffled shout in the wind and the creak of the grinding waves. "It's getting away!" You sheathed the sword and dived. Better to stay alongside the creature than to deal with importunate ghosts. The surface of the water parted for you, murky and oily, smelling like blood and tasting like effluent. You opened the back of your wrist and worked needles of bone from your distals, and from them you formed a cluster of long, ragged harpoons. You told the pain that it was not truly pain, not truly your wrist, not truly your bones, only your mind's excellent approximation thereof. You tied your perceived tendons into sinewy ropes. You raised the first harpoon. You judged. You threw. The first harpoon bounced off the trembling mess of mineral and muscle, though not before it dislodged crumbling clumps of crystal viscera. The second stuck first. The third popped its way through some gritty corneal mass and was left floating in the water in a cloud of boiling dusty fat. The fourth and fifth found their targets. You skidded and bumped behind the planet's soul as it screamed and took off. As it dragged you through the river, the water rocketed up your mind's sinuses and scoured the backs of your mind's tonsils, and so your mind vomited gouts of water as it was bumped along in a single indignity behind the proto-beast. You tugged yourself along on the slippery ropes of your own muscle and collagen, and from the shattered remnants of your javelins, you raised construct after construct. You let your javelin clatter alongside one hip and climbed alongside your skeleton crew until you had mounted the ghost entirely, clutching handfuls of full stones that tore the soft flesh of your palms, holding on to carapaceous insect tarsus, holding on to gobs of aggregate and flesh. Your constructs climbed over themselves, over the pseudo-beast. It thrashed a few back into the water, but the rest climbed on steadily, untouched by fear, and, panting, you hauled yourself up after them. To your hand, you transferred the javelin, ringed around your forearm by your seeping rope of tendon, and in the other you raised your two-handed sword. This might have been cool if it wasn't faintly ridiculous. The beast started to roll, an infant animal ghost that knew nothing but to flounder in its predator's jaws. You drove your sword into its spirit as you had driven your sword into its mantle, as the water closed over you again in a maddening rush of filthy, tainted waves. You thought, I'll end it. The skeletons, you had made their legs sharpened stakes, driven them into anything soft and jammed and glued them onto anything hard, were tilling up the damned thing with their fleshless hands. You turfed up boiling rock and flesh with your javelin, trying to scrape away the surface, trying to uncover the brain. It was too young and weak to have made a skull. Gathering up your hate, your fear, and your serenity, you thrust your javelin down the moment you perceived a wrinkle of hemisphere, straight through the lobes, and you made the spike a wheel, and you cleaved in half that which was already dead. Less than 60 seconds later, you were curled up on the surface of the planetoid, half dead with cold, trying to flush your extremities and dilate your blood vessels. Wading out of the river had never been a problem for you. You were always happy to go. The night-stricken planet had not reacted overmuch. You prided yourself on being the knife that cut silently. But the sandstorm had died as though arrested in mid-air. Particles that had been whipped miles up into the atmosphere were pattering down like rain. It grew exceedingly dark as the suns set in unison, and Mercy had clipped a little light to her ever-present clipboard as she wrote, which created a tiny corona of her pen and the clipboard and the softly falling sand. A shaft of light fell on the dead beauty of the body. She was always there when you made the cut. She was always there to welcome you home from the abattoir. She thoroughly screwed up your peripheral vision. At times you panicked and speared her through, and she would only look at you with an unreadable, lifeless expression.
One fewer for number 7 to eat on the way in, said the Saint of Joy. 8:34, she added,
because Mercy always lied when one thought she wasn't going to, and never lied when one assumed she would, and mixed it up every so often to unbalance everyone further.
Not really good enough, Harrow Hark.
You swallowed down large quantities of icy saliva in the cold, in the dark. Within your helmet, frigid strands of hair had glued themselves to the back of your neck with sweat. You were going to need another haircut. You could not keep the querulous note out of your voice when you said,
That's 2 minutes off my previous time, eldest sister. Yes, said the lictor,
and you could imagine her focus behind the dark plecs of her haz-mask as she carefully drew another line on the graph she was plotting.
You've been improving rapidly, but you could take it down in 4 minutes, infant, and it would still be not really good enough.
Your tongue slurred in your mouth.
Because these are so different from the real resurrection beast. No, said the Saint of Joy,
and her voice took on the gossamer thinness of a razor blade, poisoned by being perfectly reasonable.
You could take it down in two. You could take it down in one. But what it boils down to, baby sister, is that you've got hypothermia, and I don't.
All the way back to the Mithraeum in the tiny shuttle, you brooded on that. So many ways you had tried to contravene the inescapable fact that when you went into the river, your necromancy on the meat side fell apart. Mercy never had to ask the unkind elements for her namesake, but you were unutterably vulnerable no matter what you tried. Constructs crumbled, even ones you'd made of permanent ash. Your words faltered, your theorems failed. Bone you had manipulated would hold shape so long as you removed all artificial stimulation, but it took tedious trial and error to discover how to make your exoskeleton inert so that upon reawakening you would not find yourself weighed down by dissolved collagen. When your brain travelled back to your flesh, your arts would all spring neatly into being as though a valve had been turned to let them flow once more. But until then, this was the secret of the lictoral process. When a normal lictor's soul went to the river, the dead, blank energy that had once been their cavalier kept the lights on in their body. A normal lictor's dormant shell responded with mechanical precision to threats mundane or fantastic. It could normalize its own temperature. It could filter poisons and toxins. It could repair damage with preternatural speed. And of course, it could fight like a highly disciplined tiger. A lictor's limbs remembered all the training of her stolen second self and would use it ruthlessly and perfectly until the lictor came back to reclaim them. A normal lictor's body could look after itself. But it had become obvious to everyone. You were not a normal lictor.